in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present the live broadcast for the 26th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music, Arts, and Food Festival. This three-day celebration kicks off Friday, June 22nd, with the Good in the Hood Parade and Festival continuing Saturday, June 23rd, and ending Sunday evening, June 24th. Good in the Hood is back at King School Park at Northeast Grand Avenue. Tune into KBOO starting Saturday afternoon on June 23rd for the live broadcast. More information about Good in the Hood can be found on the KBOO.fm website on the home page.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Trump's pivot to Asia, the Trump-Kim Jong-un summit. What do the North Koreans want, and how much of what they wanted did they get? What, if anything, new emerged? What is actually in the signed agreement? How is it being spun in the United States and North Korea? What is the significance of the summit to China, Russia, Japan? Who came out ahead? What is the reaction in South Korea? South Korea is in the midst of elections comparable to U.S. midterm elections. How do relations between South Korea and its northern neighbor factor in the South Korea elections and to peace on the peninsula? Our guest is South Korea-based journalist Sean Lim. And while Trump heaps praise on North Korea's Kim Jong-un, he hurls insults to Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada. Canadians are stunned with Trump's attack on their Prime Minister following the infamous G7 meeting that took place in Canada. What is the fallout from Trump's attack on the northern neighbor of the United States? Our guest is Canada-based author and journalist Dr. Gabor Maté. Dr. Melina Abdullah joins us for our weekly Campaigners for Black Lives. What is going on in community colleges? The impact of no black representation on the local community college district board. And our weekly Earth Minute is back. Also, we want to welcome the new assistant producer to Sojourner Truth, Romero Funes. Romero, welcome. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Trump is back on U.S. soil and on Twitter, where he declared this morning there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Trump also defended his decision to end U.S. war games with South Korea in return for the North agreeing to denuclearize. That concession to Kim Jong-un appeared to catch the Pentagon and officials in South Korea off guard. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived at Osan Air Base near the South Korean capital. He met for nearly an hour with the commander of U.S. forces there before heading to Seoul to meet with South Korean President Moon Jae-in. The Japanese foreign minister is also headed to South Korea to talk with Pompeo. After those meetings, Pompeo will fly to Beijing to update the Chinese government. China and Russia long have called on the U.S. to agree to stop the provocative war games with South Korea in exchange for concessions from the North on nuclear weapons development. The Pentagon was silent on whether planned war games in August will proceed. The National Security Council has acknowledged it produced a reality TV-style video Donald Trump played for North Korea's Kim Jong-un, depicting the two leaders as heroic peace and history makers or military foes.
Destiny Pictures presents a story of opportunity, a new story, a new beginning. One of peace, two men, two leaders, one destiny. A story about a special moment in time. When a man is presented with one chance that may never be repeated, what will he choose? To show vision and leadership? Or not?
The video was credited to Destiny Pictures, but there's already a Destiny Film Production Company in California which said it had nothing to do with the film. The Guardian reports that a National Security Council spokesman didn't explain why the Trump White House at first attributed the film to a non-existent company. A former NSC spokesman called the film a harebrained idea. A Saudi-led coalition backing Yemen's exiled government began an assault on the port city of Hodeidah. The city is the main entry port for food into a country already on the brink of famine. Marie-Claire Fagali told Al Jazeera the action is likely to deepen Yemen's humanitarian disaster.
Which means that not enough will enter for the entire population of Yemen. We have already today 80% of the Yemeni people who rely heavily on humanitarian aid. Today, humanitarian aid is not enough. The civilians in Hodeidah will be caught in the hostilities. They will be caught in the war.
The assault on the Red Sea port aims to drive out Houthi rebels, who have held Hodeidah since 2015. A victory could bring a major shift in a war that has been stalemated, but it could also bring the first major street-to-street fighting. Over 10,000 people already have been killed in Yemen's civil war, which has displaced 2 million and helped spawn a cholera epidemic. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out airstrikes on weddings, hospitals, schools, and markets. The U.S. provides in-air refueling to Saudi warplanes. Donald Trump is celebrating the defeat of a South Carolina Republican congressman who has been critical of his administration. Trump tweets his advisors didn't want him to get involved in the Republican primary, thinking that Mark Sanford would easily win. But Trump said Katie Arrington was such a good candidate and Sanford was so bad, he had to give it a shot. Arrington narrowly defeated Sanford after Trump tweeted on Election Day that Sanford had been unhelpful, adding, "He's better off in Argentina." That was a reference to Sanford's surprise disappearance from the state as governor, which he later revealed was to continue his affair with an Argentine woman. Trump also congratulated loyalist Corey Stewart for winning Virginia's Republican Senate primary. The president's tweet called Virginia's Democratic Senator Tim Kaine a total stiff, adding he's weak on crime and borders and wants to raise your taxes through the roof. Stewart is an outspoken defender of Confederate symbols. He said he plans a vicious general election campaign against Kaine. California Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced legislation to end the controversial practice of Border Patrol agents separating immigrant children from their parents.
The administration is arguing that separations are required by law, but let me be clear. That's false. No law requires this action, and the Trump administration should reverse this policy today. Children are terrified, parents are heartbroken, and families are being destroyed.
The move comes as the Trump administration reportedly is considering housing thousands of unaccompanied minors in tent cities at military bases in Texas. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Before we go to our story, our lead story today, of course, the summit between Trump and the leader of North Korea, I'd just like to give a quick update on the Poor People's Campaign, which is getting very little press coverage in the mainstream media. Over 1,500 people have been arrested across the nation thus far. Each Monday, beginning on May 15th of this year, protests have happened in over 30 state capitals across the U.S. It's the first time such an action has been taken under the banner of the Poor People's Campaign, which of course was begun by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, was called for by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, but he was assassinated shortly and wasn't able to bring it to fruition, although others did. And there was an encampment in Washington, D.C. in 1968. So the Reverend William Barber and the Reverend Liz Theo Harris has now restarted the Poor People's Campaign. And basically, it's being ignored by the mainstream media, although it is unprecedented to have that many people arrested in joint actions in over 30 states. The latest is that as of Monday, the Reverend William Barber and the Reverend Liz Theo Harris were arrested. And as of yesterday, they were arrested in Washington, D.C. They were still in custody. And there have been themes for each week. Week 5's theme, which will happen this coming Monday, Everybody's Got the Right to Live, Education, Living Wages, Jobs, and Income. That was actually the week of June 10th to June 16th. And week 6, which is June 17th to June 23rd, there'll be a major mobilization happening in Washington, D.C., a new and unsettling force confronting the distorted moral narrative. Sojourner Truth will be on the ground in Washington, D.C., so we'll be able to be bringing you regular updates about what's going on the ground. There'll be workshops, there'll be civil disobedience, there'll be an encampment in the state capitol, culminating with a major rally on Saturday, June 23rd. We will try to, this week, bring you whatever updates we can, including on whether Reverend Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris, joint coordinators of the Poor People's Campaign, as to whether or not they have been released from jail. And now, by now, you've all heard about the meeting, the infamous or famous summit that took place in Singapore on Tuesday, June 12th, 2018, between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now, what really came out of the summit? Well, Trump extended an invitation to Kim Jong-un to the White House, and Trump announced on Tuesday that Kim Jong-un has accepted his invitation to the White House. And also at a news conference held after the meeting with Kim Jong-un, Donald Trump announced he would halt what he called very provocative and expensive regular military exercises that the United States holds each year with South Korea. Now, this was a surprise for South Korea. Apparently, the South Korean leader did not know that this would be part of the agreement. Now, both leaders signed a joint statement after their meeting with some vague language about working towards denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But frankly speaking, what denuclearization means to North Korea and even to South Korea may be an entirely different thing than to the Trump administration. Now, both China and Russia are praising the talks, calling them a big step in the right direction. But Iran's government warned North Korea, telling them that Trump could easily cancel the deal the same way that he canceled Iran's nuclear deal. So what was actually in The agreement, there were 4 points. The United States and North Korea commit to establish new U.S.-North Korea relations in accordance with the desire of the peoples of the two countries for peace and prosperity. That was point one. Point two, the United States and North Korea will join their efforts to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. Point three, reaffirming the April 27th, 2018 declaration, North Korea commits to work towards complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Point four, the United States and North Korea commit to recovering prisoners of war remains, MIA remains, including the immediate repatriation of those already identified. Of course, point four, important to those families who still don't have remains of their loved ones killed in the Korean War. Now, that's it. Those are the 4 points. But analysts point to the fact that there really is nothing new in those points, that those points have basically been regurgitated and reissued for the last more than two decades, as far back as 25 years ago. So nevertheless, what is new is that North Korea now, we are told, has nuclear weapons with the capacity to hit at least the west coast of the United States. And also South Korea, thereafter having a conservative government that was very much anti-North Korea, there's a government in place now that really has been brokering and building the relationship between the South and the North. Let's go to a clip now from CBS about the summit.
Kim Jong-un returned to Pyongyang while differences emerged between U.S. and North Korean accounts of the summit. North Korean state media calls the summit an epoch-making meeting and says the stability of the Korean Peninsula is thanks to the proactive, peace-loving measures taken by Kim. Ben Tracy is monitoring the North Korean reaction from Singapore. Ben, good morning.
Good morning. So that is charitably what you would call spin from the North Koreans. They are using this summit now to try to position Kim Jong-un as an equal to President Trump. But there are differences between the North Koreans and President Trump's version of what happened at their meeting. These pictures on the front page of the North Korean newspaper today are exactly what the regime wanted its people to see. Kim Jong-un looks like a respected world leader, not a brutal dictator from a poor and isolated country. In Pyongyang, the summit is being described as historic and a new era in U.S.-North Korean relations. The North Koreans claim it was Kim Jong-un who demanded that the U.S. halt what the regime calls irritating and hostile military exercises on the Korean Peninsula, a major concession by President Trump.
We will be stopping the war games.
Before the summit, President Trump said he would not give the North Koreans anything until they completely denuclearize. But the North Koreans are now saying that they actually agreed to a step-by-step process, and that usually means North Korea gets incentives along the way. John?
Ben Tracy, for us in Singapore. Thanks, Ben. Those incentives might be lifting sanctions. That's the big question.
Yeah, I was struck this morning that the U.S. military spokesperson in South Korea says they have received no updated guidance on this and that the military exercises scheduled for the fall are a go as of now.
China and South Korea have also been watched so closely here. Reaction from them?
A lot of optimism. I mean, in South Korea obviously has the most to lose and the most to gain from this. Immediately, it does seem like the prospect of any sort of military action is off the table. That's great news for South Korea. President Moon of South Korea, really influential in getting this summit to happen at all. And in China, you're seeing they're quite happy with this, especially the cessation of those military exercises. That is something China has asked for a long time. That's a big gift to them. And you're already seeing the Chinese floating the idea of easing sanctions on North Korea before there really is big progress here.
Ben, great to have you here with us. Thank you very much.
All righty. And that was a clip from CBS News. I'd now like to welcome our guest, Sean Lim, currently a freelance broadcast journalist with KBS World and EBS Radio in Seoul, South Korea. Previously, he hosted Primetime News and Late Night Edition on Arirang TV. His coverage includes South Korean politics, North Korean relations, Korea-U.S. trade, also K-pop and Korean adoption. He actually hails from the San Fernando Valley and worked in the tech industry in California. Sean Lim, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so Sean Lim, just on the ground, I do want to talk to you about the elections that are happening there and the relationship perhaps between the possibility of peace or the hope for peace with North Korea. But first, your reaction to the summit.
Well, for the summit itself, there was some hope in South Korea that there may have been a declaration of the end of the war. That would have probably been a satisfactory big win, even if denuclearization couldn't have, you know, happened in the way that the U.S. would have wanted it. But the fact that there were there wasn't that, and that it was a pretty tepid agreement. At least there was no fights, there was no embarrassment. I think it seemed like at least it was a win on all sides, that they met and they were cordial, and that there was no walking out by Donald Trump, and that Kim Jong-un looked like he, you know, wasn't going to also put up a a huge wall. This was also very important for President Moon because he was brokering this whole meeting, and at the 11th hour, it had almost been canceled yet again, and he was able to save it at the last minute. So it was, I think in general, like the fact that it was not an embarrassment was a positive for everybody.
Right. And does that pretty much express also some of the media coverage in South Korea following the summit?
The media coverage in South Korea, they, you know, they're really, there's not this fear of the weapons and like our safety the way that the American media likes to portray it, saying like, oh, South Korea has, you know, is the one to, you know, lose the most or win the most from this dangerous. Remember, like these long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads aren't aimed at South Korea. You don't need intercontinental ballistic missiles to get to South Korea. I mean, we already live under this threat. And so it is, that is a very, like, U.S. perspective. The South Korean media is more focused on, like, the day-to-day on how it may change. Like, it's very logistical. We have a script here that we've been following for years that has actually maintained a status quo of peace. But when you throw Donald Trump in the mix and then, you know, him agitating North Korea, that starts to change the script that we've been following. And so, you know, they've been, I think people were underwhelmed. The conservatives in South Korea did criticize the fact that there was no, CVID element on the agreement. But I don't think a lot of people really expected that much.
Yeah, right. Expectations were low out of the gate. Now, what doesn't really emerge much here in coverage, and thank you for pointing out to us the difference with how these weapons are seen in the South as opposed to the United States. But, you know, just generally speaking, in terms of who came out ahead of this, you know, analysts here, and you could say if you agree or not, are saying that Kim Jong-un actually came out ahead of all of this. Number one, that the Trump has at least put on hold or frozen the military exercises, what Trump calls war games, like war is a game, right? War games with South Korea that has been held every year. And of course, there's a lot of alarm, especially among the hawks here in the U.S. But the U.S. military haven't been notified. So as far as they're concerned, the war games are still going on until they hear something further. But the a big question is what really do you think, in your view, North Koreans really want? And in terms of what happened in this summit, did they get any of what they wanted out of this summit?
I think in terms of their public image being on par with the United States in this setting is something that they definitely got. But I really do think that North Korea is able to now express, or we're able to understand what they want. In the past, we've tried to put a price on their denuclearization and just say, look, how much do you want? Let's try to work with you. Just denuclearize will give you some support in terms of finances or resources. And that didn't work. And then under the conservative governments in Korea, they just were tired of any kind of negotiations. They just halted. But I think what we're seeing now is that there's now an equivalency to complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization with the North Koreans' desire for regime guarantee. It's their nuclear weapon development is not, you know, it's not what the U.S. media likes to paint as like some crazy dictator that just wants to fire missiles. They're trying to go to the last extreme resort to maintain their country and make sure that they're not invaded. And so now it seems like it makes sense where there's probably going to be a little bit more focus now that we have these vocabulary terms, CVID for CVIG. And so guaranteeing regime security for North Korea, I think, is the next game that's the new game board that I think the experts are going to have to focus on in order to really make progress on denuclearization.
Right. So North Korea basically wants some kind of sovereignty, or they're not to be under continued threat from the United States and others is what I hear out of this. And it seems as though, at least with the talk and with also the freeze of the war games, that have been provocative. I mean, we've discussed on this show, on our weekly roundtable, how provocative it is, not only for North Korea, but I must say also for China, because, of course, China being the big fish and huge player in all of this. And it seems as though the summit and what has come out of the summit, both China and Russia, both of whom have borders with North Korea, have actually praised it. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen next. And, you know, with Kim Jong-un hearing from some U.S. officials that, well, they want to use the Libyan model. And I wondered if you would want to comment on that, because many of us remember what happened in Libya, where Libya gave up its nuclear weapons only then to have its leader, Muammar Gaddafi, murdered like a dog, really, on the street. And now Libya is basically a failed state, and weapons flowing from Libya going into North Africa and destabilizing countries, Mali and others in North Africa. So when you're looking at this so-called Libya model, one then has to wonder, at the end of the day, will North Korea really give up its nuclear weapons? none of us right. can answer yeah, that exactly. question, but just, that, yeah.
Yeah, that yeah. Libya model is essentially the buzzkill in any kind of room with North Korea, because in terms of their calculations of what's happened in the world, whether they can trust a denuclearization process, that would be a real-world, worst-case scenario. And mentions of that came at exactly the wrong time. It was, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago when President Moon went all the way to Washington, met with Donald Trump, made sure that the summit in Singapore was on track. They announced that it would be on again. And then that Libya statement came out, and then North Korea's foreign ministry totally slammed the U.S. and said, we're perhaps not going to meet with you. And then there had to be an emergency meeting back on the inter-Korean border that weekend between President Moon and Kim Jong-un, and that's why we were able to see the summit in Singapore. Yeah, that essentially is the real question. I think that maybe it was a blessing in disguise to really bring attention to the fact that nuclearization lets this regime survive. It feeds its people in a strange way. If it can get concessions, it definitely allows the regime to maintain control with its own people. So it's not just a kind of a nice to have type of weapon for this country. It's absolutely necessary for their survival.
And you know, it's also always important to remind everybody that the United States is the first country to have developed nuclear weapons and the only country in the world to have used them in war, and it spends more on its nuclear arsenal than all other countries combined. I mean, the United States maintains about 1,800 nuclear weapons on high alert status, and North Korea, the arsenal comprises of fewer than 10 warheads. So that's just the reality of what we're looking at. But before you have to go, tell us, there are elections that are going on now in South Korea. Have they happened? Yeah. Kind of equivalent to our midterm elections. And what does all of this mean for South Korea President Moon Jae-in?
So we just had our local elections. There were about over 4,000 local positions, like mayors, governors, education ministers, and then some by-elections in the legislature, and it was a landslide for the Liberal Democratic Party, so it's the president's party. And so this was really a referendum in support of President Moon and the direction that he's taking South Korea. And certainly the summit helped. Of course, both of the major political parties said that the summit had limited effect. And of course, the losing conservative side said it had no effect. But certainly there was a resonance in domestic politics with the summit, because the North Korean issue is, and especially denuclearization, it's sort of like an Obamacare issue. It is used domestically to rally people on the right is anti-North Korea, and then left historically was a little bit pro-North Korea, although they've moved away from that position, and it turned into reconciliation with the North. So succeeding in reconciliation with the North is a win for the Liberal Democrats, or the president's party. The president is carrying the legacy of this hope and dream of previous liberal administrations, because he was previously the chief of staff to former president Nomihan. And so he has a lot of skin in the game to try to make the North Korean deal work, even for just his domestic political position.
Right. And it seems as though from the polls and everything else, people in the South want peace. They want this war that never ended, the Korean War, to stop. And they want peace in their country. And likely that is true for North Korea as well. Just very, very quickly, though, on a cultural note, when Kim Jong-un made the famous visit to the South, and but prior to that, during the Olympics, I noted that there were some of songs and dances, et cetera, that were done that were described, even though we didn't really understand it, that were very important to the Korean people, both South and North. After all, at the end of the day, they are one people with relatives on both sides in North and South Korea. Can you shed any light on it? Because it did seem as though there were some things, performances that were purposely done to show that bond between the Korean peoples, South and North.
I believe that they try to focus on some aspects of performance that really predate the division between North and South, because we do, share, that common history of, being under emperor and then also under Japanese occupation. So I believe one of the songs was called and they played different versions of it, because it also has some regional interpretation. So it'd be sort of like the Star Spangled Banner played to like a crowd of like maybe Civil War veterans or something
right,
like that.
Right, I see. Well, you know what? We're out of time, sadly, for this. But Sean Lim, we hope that you could join us again, because there's a lot more to this. We'll be hearing a lot more of it. But also, I'd like to discuss with you sometime soon K-pop and the role that that has played in terms of bringing North and South together. So we hope that you'll join us again soon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. South Korea-based journalist Sean Lim. We're going to take a short station break, and coming up, our weekly Earth Minute and Dr. Gabor Mate waiting in the wings to discuss the latest spat between Donald Trump and Canada and to give us his thoughts on what's going on. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Two, one, two, three, four.
All we're saying is give peace a chance. The late, great John Lennon. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook still, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We are also on SoundCloud. And today we want to give a special shout out to all of our SoundCloud listeners north of the border in the nation of Canada. We are now going to quickly go to our weekly Earth Minute, and Dr. Gabor Mate joins us on the latest Trump Canada flap.
On June 11th, 89 organizations from 34 countries called on the United Nations to end plans that promote use of biofuels and carbon offsets to supposedly green air travel, one of the fastest-growing sources of carbon emissions globally. The open letter warns the UN climate proposal could result in airlines using large amounts of biofuels made from socially and ecologically destructive palm oil. According to Simona Lovera of Global Forest Coalition, palm oil is one of the main drivers of deforestation worldwide, which itself is a major emitter of carbon, yet the UN wants airlines rewarded for burning biofuels made from it. Neely Marianne from Friends of the Earth explains the problems with airlines using carbon offsets. We cannot limit global warming to 1.5 degrees unless all states and sectors rapidly phase out their carbon emissions. There is no role for offsets. The open letter demands the UN not only reject aviation biofuel and offsetting plans, but actually reverse the growth in aviation. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, and this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, Donald Trump, number 45, as some people refer to him as, is continuing his trade war with Canada and a personal feud with Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Now, Trump has just announced that Justin Trudeau's promise not to back down from U.S. tariffs is, quote, going to cost a lot of money for the people of Canada. This comes days after the U.S. president called Justin Trudeau weak and dishonest, and he's now referring to him as Justin, right? A sign of disrespect, not referring to him by his title. Now, personal ties between 45, Trump and Trudeau, and commercial ties between the U.S. and Canada seem to be quickly dwindling. And Trump actually said that Canada's trade policies were a security threat to the United States, which, of course, Justin Trudeau, the prime minister, took exception to and basically said that Canadians are, you know, kind and polite, but they're not going to be pushed around. And apparently, this was a statement that set off Donald Trump, right? Who I guess he feels he's the only one world leader who should be pushing anybody around. And then Trump refused to sign the joint statement of declaration from that came out of the G7 summit. This, by the way, after he proposed that Russia be back in the grouping, and it returned to the G8. Russia was removed after Russia's annexation of the Ukraine. So let's find out from someone across the border what he thinks is all about. I mean, why is Donald Trump dissing our northern neighbor? I'd like to welcome Dr. Gabor Mate. Dr. Gabor Mate, welcome.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
Okay, yes. Really great to have you back. Dr. Gabor Mate, a physician, author, seminar leader, acclaimed public speaker. His best-selling books include Scattered, When the Body Says No, and Hold On to Your Kids. He's a former medical columnist for the Vancouver Sun and the Globe and Mail, and is based in Vancouver, Canada. So, Dr. Gabor Mate, why do you think, I mean, how do you explain this? It's really difficult to figure out why, on the one hand, Trump is dissing the Canadian Prime Minister, while on the other hand, praising Kim Jong-un. Your analysis of what's happening.
Well, I'm going to have to disagree with you this morning.
Okay.
First of all, there's nothing new. There's nothing absolutely new about this kind of rancor between Americans and Canadians. I have quoted you a Canadian prime minister about an American president who said he's a hothead, he's a fool, too brash, too inexperienced, and a boastful son of a bitch. You'd think it's Justin Trudeau talking about Trump, but it isn't. It's Prime Minister John Kenneth Diefenbaker speaking about President John Kennedy in 1962.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In 1965... LBJ grabs the Canadian Prime Minister by the shirt collar in the White House, lifts him off the floor, and she yells at him, "You pissed on my rug." This is after the Canadian Prime Minister criticized the war in Vietnam.
Wow.
In 1971, Richard Nixon calls Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, Justin's father, an asshole, and Trudeau responds, "I've been called worse things by better people." Again in 1971, Nixon says that Trudeau, again the father, is a pompous egghead, and you got to put it to these people for kicking the U.S. around after what we did for that lousy son of a bitch. So let's just forget this idea of of beautiful relationship and rancorless interaction. The fact is, the America is an imperial power, and it never likes its colonies, its allies, taking any independent stand. And in return, these allies resent that kind of attempt at control and overbearing power. So this has been going on for a long time. The only difference between between Trump and the others is that the others did it privately, whereas Trump, in his complete lack of self-regulation, does it publicly. But the fundamental situation has not changed. So that's the first point. The second point is that, contrary to what you said in the introduction, Russia did not colonize or take over the Ukraine. It's a civil war in the Ukraine with ethnic Russians fighting ethnic Ukrainians, and Putin supports the Russians. America supports all kinds of people all over the world in all kinds of civil wars. And as far as the annexation of Crimea, Crimea used to be a part of Russia for centuries, given to Ukraine only by Khrushchev in the 1970s or 60s. And if the Americans can invade Panama, surely the Russians can invade the Crimea. So let's
Dr. Mate, I'll have to say I agree with you on during the whole crisis in Crimea. We did alleged crisis. We did a lot of coverage on it, including the U.S. fomenting and supporting the guy who was in charge of Ukraine at the time. So you're right in pointing that out and reminding our listeners of that.
So I'm not here to support Trump by any means whatsoever. You know, my view of Trump is that he's a highly traumatized person who's now imposing his trauma on the rest of the world. There's an article in the New York Times this morning by Thomas Friedman, who is one of my least favorite columnists, but he says that America is trying to remake, Trump is trying to remake America in his own image, as selfish and arrogant and so on. Well, that's true. And Trump is selfish and arrogant because he's very defensive and narcissistic, and he was made that way by a very horrible childhood, and he's a very traumatized person who's now imposing his trauma on the rest of the world. I just want to put into historical context that this is not about one particular personality. It's about a whole set of colonial empire relationships. It's been going on for a long, long time.
Yeah, and I think you're right on that. I mean, I'm from a country that is part of a quote-unquote Commonwealth, and first the UK, Barbados, the UK, but now the United States really having so much control, so that the whole imperial power and colonial mentality. But also, you know, back in the day, people used to talk about the quote-unquote ugly American, you know, people... Yeah. When Americans traveled abroad, they had a sense of this kind of brash, selfish, self-absorbed person. That's not to speak for all of the people in the United States, but it just does seem to me as though Donald Trump is now publicly, I mean, the man who embodies all of that is now the man who's been put in charge of the United States. And then a lot of people who knew that this kind of behavior by the United States had been going on before are freaking out because now it's all public for the world to see. Not that I don't think there's any, that I do think there's a difference between Trump and some of the others, for example. I mean, the guy's a racist, among other things, overt racist. Yeah.
Well, I he would not be the first American president to be a racist.
Certainly not. You know,
but the point is, I agree with you. He stylistically and what you can say, sort of aesthetically, he makes America looks really, really bad. But in terms of actual relationships and policies, like, he's a very bizarre personality, and it must be difficult for a lot of Americans to witness him in the White House speaking on their behalf. But let's, as these quotes from these various Canadian prime ministers and American presidents indicate, it's not really all that new. And I suppose the question for the Americans is, how did such a bizarre personality come to represent you? Whereas before you had smoother talking, more self-contained people in the White House. But, you know, as far as Canadian opinions of American presidents is concerned, it was a top aide to Jean Chrétien, who's a Canadian prime minister, called George W. Bush, you know, George Bush Sr., a moron, you know. So this kind of rancor, it's not new, and it's a product of a long history. So I guess what I'm resisting here is this horrified throwing up of hands about how terrible Trump is, when I'm telling you this has been going on for a long, long time. And I think our disdain and our natural resistance to the arrogance and the absolute solipsistic and narcissistic personality of a Trump should not make us believe that things have changed that much.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a continuation of a long history there. Well, Gabor Mate, we appreciate you straightening us out on some of this. And, you know, the history that you mentioned, right? None of that, of course, is being reported, you know, in the U.S. press. So we're very glad that you were able to join us today and that you were able to bring this out. We follow your work very closely here on Sojourner Truth, Dr. Gabor Mate, and we are looking forward to speaking with you again soon. Usually we're talking to you about other topics, but there's no doubt that the whole system of capitalism, fundamentally, whether it's wearing its hard hat or its soft hat, creates suffering for so many people, not only north of the border, but around the world. That's my view anyway.
You know, not naturally, in Canada, there's a lot of outrage and so on. But Canadians also forget their history. You know, like they all this stuff that I just read out to you, it's not secret information, but most people are not aware of it.
Right.
That's just how it is. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gabor Mate. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now with Fun Drive over, we can return to our weekly series of campaigners for Black Lives. And we'd like to welcome Dr. Malina Abdullah, professor, author, community campaigner based in Los Angeles. She is professor and chair of the Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State University, Los Angeles, and immediate past campus president and current counsel for affirmative action chair for the California Faculty Association, which is the faculty union. She earned her doctorate from the University of Southern California in political science and her bachelor's from Howard University in African American Studies. And she, of course, is well known throughout Southern California as being with one of the founders of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. Dr. Malina Abdullah, welcome back.
Hi, Margaret. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So what's going on? I know you've been concerned about the recent community college district board elections. And what does that have to do with Black Lives Mattering in education and generally?
Yeah. So we have a whole portion of Black Lives Matter called Black Lives Matter in the Schools. And part of that work is both making sure that our children and our young people are not over-policed in schools, but also ensuring that they receive an education that's really grounded in who we are. And so this is kind of the intersection of my work as a Black Lives Matter organizer and as a Pan-African Studies scholar. And so I was recently asked, and I always keep my eye towards the community colleges, because if we look at what's happening to Black students in higher education in California especially, but throughout the nation, we see a decline, a plummeting of Black students enrolled in higher education, with the exception of historically Black colleges and universities, where there's actually an increase. And of course, I applaud that. As a graduate of Howard University myself, I believe that HBCUs are the best place for Black students. But the reality is, most Black students will not, especially if they're from California, go all the way across the country to attend an HBCU. And so we've seen the CSU, the UC, kind of be a place where Black students can go. But that's declining. Even the California State University system, which is supposed to be the most accessible of the four-year university systems, we're looking at only a 4% Black student enrollment across the campuses. And it's even lower in Southern California. You'd think a place like Cal State LA would have a really high number of Black students, or at least proportionate number, but we're below 4%. We're at 3.8% at this point. So where are Black students? Black students are in the community colleges more than any other space. So the Los Angeles Community College District is the largest community college district in the nation, and it has a 12% Black student enrollment rate. Sydney Camlager Dove was the only Black representative on its governing board, and she was recently elected to assembly, so she stepped down from the 7-member board. And it was assumed, when the board decided that they were going to appoint rather than have a special election, it was assumed that her successor would also be Black and probably a Black woman. And so there were about 5 highly qualified Black candidates. I'm going to count myself as one who was highly qualified, but there was also Valerie Lynn Shaw, who is on the California Board of Governors for the community colleges. There was a brother named Peter Brown, who was highly qualified. There was a Dallas Fowler, who's embedded in the Democratic Party. Not that I think that that makes you qualified, but she had a lot of support. And the Community College Board, which currently has 3 Latino males, 1 Asian male, 1 white male, and 1 white woman, decided unanimously despite the overwhelming community support. So there were lots of Black Lives Matter organizers there. There were students who were currently enrolled in community colleges. There were alumni. There were community organizers and clergy and community leaders all there. And there were 23 public comments. All of them were supportive of the Black candidates, save two. And they decided instead to appoint a fourth Latino male to the board, meaning that for the next 2.5 years in terms of leadership in the community college district, which is the primary a system that serves Black students, there will be no Black leadership on that board. So that's an issue for Black Lives Matter, who doesn't just care. We don't just care about, you know, what happens to Black people and the killing of Black people at the hands of police. We also believe that we need to transform systems and make them accessible to Black people. And so that's kind of the lowdown on what happened recently, and it begs the question of how do we kind of engage systems and transform systems, and also how do we build solidarity with progressive Latinos. I should add that the Latino male who nominated the one who is now succeeding, Sidney Kamlager, the person succeeding him, her, is his name is David Vela, who has no, he was one of the least qualified candidates.
Right.
The person who nominated him is a Trump supporter.
Right. Well, that really tells you a lot, and really trying to fan the flames of disunity, Black brown disunity, while you and others are working for that unity. Dr. Malina Abdullah, we're going to have to leave it there because we've been warned that sometimes our show runs a little too long, and that can't be the case. But we'll have you back, and of course, we'll be continuing our weekly series of Campaigners for Black Lives. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Malina Abdullah.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. I'd like to thank and welcome our new assistant producer, Romero Funes, and our long-term intern, Sherelle Withers, and our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Radio is proud to co-sponsor IRANFORM, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The IRANFORM will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at Mississippi Studios in Portland. The Northwest Deaf Arts Festival consists of a family-friendly matinee show as well as an adult-only 21 and over evening show. Performers include hip-hop artist Sean Forbes, dancer Antoine Hunter, poet Raymond Luzak, and more. Again, that's the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. Mississippi Studios is located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulations and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Members of Congress and immigration activists blocked the entrance to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection headquarters Wednesday, protesting the Trump administration's policy of separating families at the border. This from L.A. Times. 10 House members, including Representatives Judy Chu, Jimmy Gomez, John Lewis, Joseph Crowley, and Luis Gutierrez, wore white armbands to signify their intention to be arrested in an act of civil disobedience. The representatives sought to draw attention to a policy many of them called immoral and inhumane. Representative Pramila Jayapal said the issue had not received the congressional scrutiny it deserved. Gutierrez told a crowd of about 200 people at Freedom Plaza, quote, "I cannot think of an act that is more cruel and more inhumane than to rip a child from the arms of a mother," end quote. Jayapal said that on Saturday she visited migrant mothers being held in a federal detention center south of Seattle. Quoting again, "What I saw," she said, "was outrageous, inhumane, cruel, unethical. They were told they were going to take showers or be photographed, and when they came back, their children